Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, pledging to help end child hunger in the Carolinas through ongoing support of Second Harvest Food Bank of Metrolina. Details about this initiative at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, COVID infections continue to be the big story as we enter 2022 with record numbers of infections in the state and nationwide. This week, North Carolina logs the highest number of cases in a single day since the start of the pandemic. Redistricting is also back in the news with the first trial centering on new voter maps drawn in the shadow of the census. We have details. And this year marks 1 year since the insurrection at the Capitol and the attack on American democracy. Although we all saw it as it happened on national television and the tape still exists, Democrats and Republicans view the event very differently. We get into all of that and more with our panel of reporters. They include WFAE's health reporter Claire Donnelly. Welcome back. Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year, Mike.
And Happy New Year to the rest of our panel, which includes Hunter Sines, a reporter anchor for WCNC TV. Good morning.
Good morning, Mike.
Seema Iyer is chief legal correspondent for WJZY, Fox 46, and what a great week to have you on this program. Welcome back.
Happy New Year, everybody.
And Mary C. Curtis is with us. She is a columnist for RollCall.com and host of their Equal Time podcast. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
So on Wednesday, North Carolina topped its record for daily COVID cases. We logged more than 20,000 cases in a single day for the first time since the beginning of the pandemic back in 2020. If we can all remember back that far, Claire, was that unanticipated, that number?
Oh, no. I mean, this is what we've been seeing across the country. You know, COVID-19, or the Omicron variant of the coronavirus is super contagious. Cases are exploding everywhere.
That number was actually closer to 21,000, 20,770 to be exact. And I'm not sure, that was on Wednesday. I'm not sure what yesterday's number was.
24,292. Okay. So we broke it again.
Okay. So it brings the number of confirmed coronavirus cases to almost 2 million. This is happening nationwide. What are the national numbers? Do we know? Claire? We don't know.
I mean, I know that they're exploding. I don't know the total. Sorry. I'm sorry. Okay. I'm the local COVID reporter.
All right. Well, I will tell you this, that the record on Monday, according to Johns Hopkins, was 1,082,549. Did you want to chime in on that, Seema?
Nationally, I read this morning that our 7-day average is 98% nationally of what it was at the COVID peak. So that gives you some perspective on how bad things are.
And Anthony Fauci, who's the nation's top infectious disease expert, says maybe these numbers are not the thing we should be looking at anymore. He told ABC's This Week that the country is seeing almost a vertical increase in cases and that even a lower rate of hospitalizations could strain already overwhelmed hospitals.
We've got to be careful about that, because even if you have a less of a percentage of severity, when you have multi-fold more people getting infected, the net amount is you're still going to get a lot of people that are going to be needing hospitalization. And that's the reason why we're concerned about stressing and straining the hospital system.
And he says perhaps that is the number we should be looking at, the number of hospitalizations. Reports from earlier in the week indicate that 112,941 Americans are hospitalized with COVID-19, and 26% of ICU beds are occupied by those patients. Put that number into context with what happened earlier in the pandemic and paint the picture, Claire, of what's happening at hospitals here in this region. Are we reaching a point yet where we are going to be overburdening hospital systems?
Right. So what's frustrating about this is we used to get a biweekly data report from Mecklenburg County. Then we got a weekly data report from Mecklenburg County. Now we're getting a monthly report from Mecklenburg County. So we actually don't have as up-to-date hospitalization information as we used to. But both Novant and Atrium did media availabilities earlier this week and said they are seeing high volumes of COVID patients. In North Carolina, hospitalizations have been hanging around 3,000, which is about where we were in winter 2021. So we're still not at, you know, where we were at the peak of the winter surge. But as Fauci said, you know, the concern is the more infections increase, the more hospitalizations will likely also increase.
Hunter.
Yeah, I was just going to say, you know, following up on Claire's point, although we don't have as much data, I've been told from people inside both hospital systems that there have been multiple days, if not consecutive weeks, especially around the holidays and hereafter, in which all of the emergency room departments have seen 50 plus people in their waiting room. And so people are spending hours, whether it's COVID or not COVID, because they cannot get them in and seen fast enough. So to Dr. Anthony Fauci's point, even though hospitalizations, you know, aren't skyrocketing right now, it is putting a strain just because so many people are getting sick and filling these EDs.
Claire?
Also, you know, health officials have been and hospital leaders have been urging over and over, please do not go to the emergency room to get a COVID-19 test. We know the lines are long at testing sites, but the emergency room is not the place to do that because they need to keep that space for folks who are really sick, either with COVID or something else.
I don't believe we've heard from our local hospital systems about how this is necessarily impacting them, but we did get a report yesterday that ICUs in the Triangle area are filling up. Do we understand why it's worse in that area of the state than it may be here? Okay, we don't know. We do know also that this is impacting emergency rooms. So Medic, which is Mecklenburg County's emergency medical services agency, says they're making changes to meet the rise in demand with fewer employees. This has to do with ambulance service. What are the changes?
So they started doing this back in October, or they have started, you know, issuing changes on and off throughout the pandemic just because they're short-staffed. They have folks, when they test positive, obviously you can't go out in an ambulance. One of them is that they're pivoting to using rideshare services, so encouraging people. They have this sort of triage process when you call Medic in need of an ambulance, and they kind of gauge how serious what you're experiencing is. And if what you know, if you don't need urgent medical attention, maybe you don't have insurance and use the ER as your primary mode of healthcare, then they'll say, great, we're going to call you an Uber or a Lyft so you have transportation to the hospital. That's one thing. Also, you may have to wait longer for an ambulance when you call because they just don't have the staff.
I mean, you may have COVID and may not be terribly symptomatic, but want to see a doctor in the emergency room. And since you're not in dire straits, they're going to tell you to take a Lyft or Uber. How does Lyft or Uber feel about that? How do drivers feel about it? Because they're unlike ambulance drivers, they are not isolated from their passengers.
Right. So this is not a new thing. You know, other places across the country have also done this with rideshare services. I mean, I would say I don't know the ins and outs of the triage process that Medic has, but I would assume that if they suspect that the person is COVID positive, there's a different protocol they run through.
Why is Medic experiencing these staff shortages at the moment?
Oh, they've been experiencing staff shortages for forever. They're handling, you know, burnout of healthcare workers, just all of the reasons that we're hearing about people quitting their jobs and struggling with staff across the country.
Of course, they also have 50 people out with COVID right now as well.
Right.
Yeah. And that's
it's interesting, too, that it's so many people have heard that Omicron is not as severe as Delta. And so I think they feel that they can go out more and it will be less severe. But all the CDC and doctors are warning that this is if you are vaccinated and boosted. If you're not, it could be a very serious illness. And we also have a boom in pediatric cases because so many young children aren't vaccinated.
And so many young children, 5 and under, cannot be vaccinated yet because the vaccine hasn't been approved for them. We are experiencing this surge in cases. Is that because of the holidays, the Thanksgiving, Christmas, New Year's holidays, and the get-togethers that were associated with those? Or is it due to something else, just the fact that winter is setting in and we're spending more time indoors and this Omicron variant seems to be far more contagious, more easily pass from one person to another? What's the cause?
I think it's a perfect storm, right? It's all of those things. Oh. It's Omicron is highly contagious. People were gathering. More people were going to see loved ones for the holidays. Definitely, you know, before this Omicron surge, there was a sense of kind of a return to normalcy for vaccinated folks. But now, again, of course, with Omicron being super contagious, that's not exactly the case. Seema, sorry.
Yeah, no, I was just read something really interesting this morning, and that in South Carolina, this is according to their state epidemiologist, Dr. Bell, says that the age 20 to 40 is driving their current surge. So the question is, because South Carolina only has a, I think, 51.4% fully vaccinated rate, the question is, are this 20 to 40 group not vaccinated? Is that why they're driving the current surge?
We should also mention the boosters thing, just that the timing of when boosters were encouraged for everybody wasn't until after Thanksgiving. So people could have gotten together at Thanksgiving, not realizing, you know, they weren't as protected as they could have been had they gotten their booster shot before.
Bank of America was recommending that their employees not return to work until the 3rd of January. But now, just this morning, they announced they'd like their employees to stay home until January, through the week of January the 10th. Is that a harbinger of things to come, do you think, with employers here and around the country?
I mean, sorry. Okay. I mean, I guess it's sort of an individual decision. That would be my guess. You know, we're seeing universities, a lot of places where, you know, folks would have been getting together inside in big groups, you know, whether masked or unmasked, concern over Omicron has certainly led to a lot of shifts. So that's definitely possible.
So this variant is wildly more contagious, evidently, than the previous strains, and it's crowding out the Delta variant. Have other variants been spotted, do we know, elsewhere in the world that might be the next version of this virus that may be less or more contagious, less or more virulent once you get it? Do we know?
You know, I don't know, but I will say that with Omicron, I am suspicious, and I think that that will probably happen. Certainly, you know, the reason viruses exist is to infect as many people as possible. So it's highly probable that somewhere out there, the coronavirus is continuing to mutate and change. That's what viruses do. I think it would be naive to think that there is not going to be something like this coming again.
And is
we just
it
had health experts say that there is a new variant, perhaps in Marseille, coming out of France. And as Claire said, it is inevitable. They're still looking into it, but let's just face it. Yes, this is a very smart mutating virus. And yes, they say there's another one popped up in France now. So
you're anthropomorphizing a virus. But that's okay. is it true that those who are unvaccinated are actually helping this virus to mutate? Is that true?
Well, that is at least what I heard Atrium and Novant. I mean, that's what they're saying. Claire can correct me if I'm wrong, but that at least in the Carolinas, that is what I'm hearing, is that the unvaccinated still that are predominantly showing up in the hospitals and the numbers.
Right. So the more chances the virus has to replicate, the more people it can infect, the more it mutates. So
you mentioned boosters a moment ago. We'll talk about that and more with regard to how COVID is changing things and how things around COVID are changing as well. And then we'll talk about redistricting. Oh, my goodness gracious me. All on Charlotte Talks in just a moment. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks and the Local News Roundup on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Claire Donnelly, WFAE's healthcare reporter. Mary C. Curtis is a columnist for RollCall.com and host of their Equal Time podcast. Hunter Sines is a reporter anchor for WCNC TV. And Seema Iyer is the chief legal correspondent for WJZY TV, Fox 46. Hospital systems in our area mandated employees be vaccinated, but neither Atrium nor Novant plan to mandate booster shots for employees. Dr. David Priest is an infectious disease physician at Novant Health.
Our team members stepped up and got vaccinated. So we're strongly encouraging them to get a booster, and we're evaluating that every single day. A high percentage of our team members have already had a booster, and others still are not in the window where a booster would be necessary.
So here we go again with confusion, contradictory messages that call into question everything that health officials tell us, because while Dr. Priest says boosters aren't necessary for Novant's employees, National Health officials are not only stressing the need for boosters, they're also telling us that perhaps a regular series of boosters might be necessary going forward. And in fact, Governor Roy Cooper said this just this week.
Really being up to date on your vaccination is making sure you get boosted.
Claire, how do you explain this?
Right. So we have not gotten a clear answer from Atrium or Novant about why they are not planning to mandate booster shots for their employees. I will say, you know, part of what Dr. Priest is saying in that clip you played is that some folks aren't in the window yet. So remember, Novant gave everybody until September 15th, I believe, to get boosted. So they're basically saying, I mean, to get vaccinated. So there's some, you know, question over who is eligible when with this 5 month, 6 month deadline. But yeah, we don't really have a clear answer on that. Obviously, the Supreme Court today is taking up the Biden vaccine or test mandate. So I think there's a little bit of wait and see happening. Seema?
No, I think it's disturbing that Novant and Atrium aren't taking a position on this, whereas on December 27th, UNCC sent out a memo to all their students and employees and said, if you come back January 4th and you are not boosted, you had to be boosted to come back, otherwise you're going to get weekly testing. So, and this was for students and employees. And I know there's a lot of confusion when it comes to universities and colleges in the Carolinas. Some have mandates just for vaccines. Some of those mandates are just for students. Some have booster mandates just for students. Some are just for employees. There's a lot of confusion. But the bottom line is, if our schools are taking this step, why wouldn't our healthcare facilities?
So federal vaccination requirements are supposed to take effect next week with companies employing more than 100 people. The Supreme Court is taking that up to see if that's constitutional, if a presidential administration can mandate such a thing. If they decide that that's not constitutional, will that impact an individual employer's mandate of their own employees, Seema?
Not necessarily. So the law of the land still remains that mandates, vaccine mandates, can be issued by employers, period, full stop. It's been good law since 1905, Jacobson versus Massachusetts, smallpox. Now, I just want to be clear that a booster mandate can add on to the vaccine mandate under the law. So the employer still can go forward with that. Now, the alternative is if you come to work and you are not boosted and or vaccinated, then your employer has the legal right to have you tested periodically. Usually it's weekly. If you don't agree to be tested weekly, then you can be fired. You have to go home. That's it.
There is some question, obviously, about the legality of a mandate from the federal government coming down to employers, and it usually takes...
Yes, that's separate.
It usually takes months or a long time for the Supreme Court to decide they will hear the case. They seem to have decided this in lightning speed, but how long might it take...
Well, this is an emergency.
Two questions. How long might it take them to arrive at a decision on this? And why haven't they stopped the mandate from taking effect until they make that decision?
So They could do that today. So they could say, okay, we're enjoining it from going into effect until we've decided, because there are just so many briefs, like, you know, other people putting in their two cents and these amicus briefs, and they have to consider all that. They could come up with a decision next week, but technically the session doesn't start till January 10th. So this is all under emergency advisement. The other question that remains that people have always asked, why doesn't the federal government just issue a national vaccine mandate? The answer is that Congress has to then approve it. So there is a much longer drawn out process, and everything that we deal with these days is under emergency, which is why three ex-White House advisors just filed op-eds yesterday, I think in the Journal of Medical something. So, you know, they're basically saying, we keep doing this, we keep responding to emergencies, why aren't we being more proactive? Sorry, Mike.
That's okay. The preamble to the Constitution says the government can operate in the interest of the general welfare. Could it not be argued that mandating vaccines during the time of a pandemic that has taken nearly a million lives is operating in the general interest of the general welfare?
Absolutely. And that's why Congress could also act under an emergency provision. And enact
why does it require Congress, if the president, any president, has the power to issue these executive orders that then become essentially the law of the land?
Well, that is the way the law is written, that there, he does require this congressional approval. And that, again, things always could change. Like you're saying, in an emergency situation, does he have the power? I mean, even as commander in chief, I would say, yes, he has the power, because public safety and public health always trump individual liberties.
There's also the question of military personnel getting these vaccines and getting the booster shots, and they're having difficulty in getting some military personnel to do that. Why? These people are soldiers. Why aren't they being summarily dismissed, dishonorably discharged for refusing to obey an order?
I think it's politics. I don't know if anybody else has an opinion on this, but I think the reason the soldiers aren't getting vaccinated is politics. And perhaps that's why the leaders aren't summarily dismissing them as well. I mean, there's just no other reason, because there are these vaccine mandates in effect.
This week, President Biden said he was doubling the number of antiviral pills that his administration has ordered to fight this disease. What about those pills, Claire? Who are they for? What do they do? When will they become available? And who will pay for all of this?
Yeah, so the pills, you know, it's a treatment for COVID-19. It's huge. It's exciting. They're really important. Another tool in the arsenal, right, in fighting, you know, getting seriously ill with COVID-19. The one thing I will say is that, you know, over and over, what we hear from health officials is, please do not see these new treatments as, you know, justification for not getting vaccinated. Still your best defense against getting seriously sick and hospitalized with COVID-19 is to get vaccinated and get boosted.
Are these pills preventative? Do they lessen the symptoms if you catch it? What do they do? These pills.
Yeah, they lessen the symptoms if you catch it. The idea is to basically keep you out of the hospital, enable you to get a prescription for an antiviral pill.
So you would take these pills after becoming infected, or
yes,
to prevent infection?
After you get it. Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So the good news here, if there is good news to be had, I suppose, is that this situation might, we are told, improve in 6 to 8 weeks. They're saying the surge might end. Why? Is that because we will be past the holiday period in which everybody gathered, and therefore it will burn itself out?
I mean, like with so much modeling, we're looking at other countries, we're looking at other places where Omicron has peaked and then started to decline. So, I mean, but also like modeling, it's not perfect. Things could change. We're not, you know, obviously we're not the same population as those other countries. We have different levels of vaccination, different populations becoming infected. So, like, it's not an exact science.
And aren't some of the health officials saying that it's eventually going to be one of those things that we are going to learn to live with it, in a sense?
Yes.
It's going to become an endemic and not a pandemic. Yeah.
Exactly.
Last year, the rules surrounding booster shots began to change. At first, we said 6 months after your second shot, if you're a Pfizer or Moderna person, you would get your booster. Then they began saying you should get it at 5 months instead of six. And now the rules on masks appear to be changing with the Omicron variant. We're told that cloth masks that so many of us have invested in aren't as effective at stopping the Omicron variant as N95 masks. Why and how easy are the N95 masks to get? Because they were difficult to find for a long time.
Right. So the issue, I guess, here is going back to, you know, Omicron. The Omicron variant is a very successful version of the coronavirus because it has all of these mutations. And one of the mutations is that it's more easily transmissible. So you want the best protection possible. And in some cases, you know, as we've seen, the cloth masks, you know, certainly aren't standardized. N95s are. KN95s are, for the most part. So basically, the lower the chance that virus particle has at entering your respiratory system, the better. So that's why health officials have pivoted to recommending that instead of cloth masks. Or this double masking is also back, which is the surgical mask with the cloth mask on top. You just want as little air escaping that's unfiltered as possible.
This pandemic has irrevocably changed so much about American life, including the fact that many industries and economic sectors are being impacted by sick outs. Some people are legitimately ill. Some people are taking advantage of it, I suppose. But there are staffing shortages in everything from the airline industry to schools. What is the situation here, Seema? Is this legit? Or do we know? Or is this people taking advantage of the fact that they can do this and say, well, I'm sick?
Well, here's the problem. They can take advantage and say they're sick and then say the line is too long, so I can't get tested, or I can't buy the at-home test. So therefore, I'm telling you I'm sick and here are my symptoms, right? But if you look at, let's say, the jail system or the prison system, you know, that's a place where they are really having problems, A, getting people vaccinated and boosted, and B, staffing shortages. I mean, there's just tremendous staffing shortages in our, at least local jails. And it is because of people being sick and also because of these low vaccination numbers. And this is carrying over to everything from teachers to daycare to our Walmart closed last week, right? You know, so it's just filtering everywhere.
And we have seen, Hunter, these long lines of people around the country waiting just to get tested or to get those at-home COVID-19 test kits. And this week, StarMed Healthcare on South Boulevard shut down for a while after a neighbor threatened staff members with a shotgun on Wednesday morning. What else can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so basically what we've been told is, as we've seen these long lines going all the way through neighborhoods, in this case, off of South Boulevard, cutting off driveways, you can probably understand the frustration, not saying that this is what needed to have happened, of course, but clearly people are still heated in this world that we live in. And so what happened is there was a call about a neighbor who came out of his house, of course, pointing a gun at staff and people in line, was clearly frustrated for some reason. Police were called. They decided that there was nothing, I guess, wrong happened here technically, and no charges could be filed. I was told last night by the CEO of StarMed, which I thought was just kind of really neat to hear, is that the staff member who the gun was pointed at is so devoted to trying to help with our problem here in COVID that she actually returned to the job the same day and continued testing. She said, like, I don't want to go home. I just want to continue doing my job, which I thought was kind of moving. But we don't have a lot of details as far as exactly what happened based on just what StarMed and police are telling us.
Well, actually, there were two incidents, Mike. I know some people weren't reporting that, but our Lindsay Klein, she got an exclusive. And there was a lot of confusion. You know, Hunter was explaining that. But when she got to the scene, there was actually two incidents. There was another gentleman who was also a neighbor, and he had a gun. He didn't take it out. He's another person who didn't have the dogs. And he was getting into it with another neighbor about blocking his driveway. So there were these two incidents happening, and there was just so much confusion. And again, you know, it's what Hunter said. It's these long lines that are just driving up frustration. Sorry, Claire.
No, I was just going to, this raises the larger question of security for the folks waiting in line and for the folks working at these testing sites. The StarMed CEO says that they're working to hire off-duty CMPD officers to come in and help with security so that this doesn't happen. But of course, you have a lot of people who are frustrated with having to wait a long time, and neighbors who are frustrated with all of the traffic. So
very quickly, we heard about the terrible damage that a year of remote learning has caused, particularly younger students in the primary and secondary systems. And most school systems started the year by resuming in-class learning, but they're starting 2022 by going back to remote learning. And many colleges and universities made similar decisions, including UNC Charlotte, Queen's University of Charlotte, Johnson & Wales University, and Clinton College in Rock Hill. But some students, like UNC's Natalia Walker, who attends UNC Chapel Hill, told WCNC she is frustrated with being back on campus.
I understand wanting the full experience of school. At the very least, I think the flexibility of having the option of hybrid classes could be a good middle ground.
Lenoir Ryan University is delaying the start of school in the new year, and Wingate is also starting with a staggered schedule. What's happening with secondary and primary schools here?
Anybody? Secondary primary school, I mean, they're still going at it in person, you know, whether mask optional or there are masks. We are expecting to hear a change to the state, I believe it's NC Safety, the toolkit.
Safe schools toolkit, safe, yes.
There we go. Where's Ann Doss Helms when we need her, right? But we are expecting an update to that in regards to back to in-school. But for right now, Mike, I mean, all of our local area school districts are back in person after this winter break.
And because I don't want to launch into a whole complicated topic of redistricting in the last 45 seconds of this segment, we will end our COVID discussion here with the fact that it's having an impact on liquor stores. Mecklenburg County tells us that they're cutting hours again because of staff shortages. And the ABC board is telling us that despite supply chain issues, liquor sales are on pace to set record levels in the organization's 75-year history, the moral for which is COVID is driving us all to drink. We'll take a break. We'll come back and talk about redistricting and more with our local news roundup. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's the local news roundup on Charlotte Talks here on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Claire Donnelly, our healthcare reporter, is with us, along with Hunter Sines, reporter, anchor for WCNC TV, Seema Iyer, chief legal correspondent for Fox 46, and Mary C. Curtis, columnist for Roll Call, host of their Equal Time podcast. North Carolina is back in court this week arguing over voter maps. The trial ended yesterday with a verdict predicted, I believe, for Tuesday of next week. We'll spend a substantial portion of Monday's program talking about this, but today, since this is the local news roundup, let's talk about it a bit now. This trial is over the latest voter maps drawn in the shadow of the 2020 census. As has happened before, there are those who don't like the maps and who say that they were unfairly drawn to favor Republicans over Democrats. A three-judge panel, two Republicans and a Democrat, heard the case, although it is likely to go to a Democrat-majority Supreme Court, no matter what happens in this case. And they heard from Michigan political science professor, I hope I say his name corrected, Chaui Chen, who testified for the plaintiffs, saying that his computer simulation of 1,000 potential maps demonstrate that the GOP-approved map is a partisan outlier which cannot be explained by North Carolina's political geography. Seema, what the heck does that mean?
you think 1,000 maps is a lot? Wait a second here. There was another math professor, expert witness for the plaintiffs, Dr. Mattingly. He drew 100,000 different maps and came to the same conclusion. And then we had another math professor from Carnegie Mellon for the plaintiffs, and he said that he testified that the legislature's congressional map is more biased in favor of Republicans than 99.9% of the billions of maps he created. So the plaintiffs, they had all these political scientist experts, mathematician experts. They had just tremendous amount of data to support their position that these 2020 maps, it's called the 2021 plan, are basically in our partisan gerrymandering. The problem here is racial gerrymandering is what has been for decades since the 80s against the law. But partisan gerrymandering hasn't been addressed. There are 20 states in this country that outlaw partisan gerrymandering. And sad to say, North Carolina isn't one of them. So when I cannot minimize the historical significance of this trial and this outcome, not just on the North Carolina, but in the country. And I know Mary and I talked about this offline. She has a lot of perspective on this as well.
But there are two suits. There are two suits. One argues that the new maps disenfranchise Black voters and dilute their political power. The second says the maps divide Democratic and left-leaning voters to create safe seats for Republicans. So, Mary, given that one suit deals with race, which is illegal, what does that do?
Well, the thing of it is, in North Carolina, as in many other places, racial and partisan gerrymandering do kind of converge because of the makeup of the parties, the Republican Party being majority white. And so that's what complicates it. Plus, North Carolina has a history of being in court over its maps. And we saw before when we had maps and voting rules tossed out or changed because the federal court found that they went after Black voters with, quote, almost surgical precision, it's going to mean that basically they're going to be looked at with skepticism when they draw maps that resemble those old maps, particularly when they break up urban or cities like Greensboro. They pretty much wrote Democratic Congresswoman Kathy Manning's, they eliminated her district because of it. So it will, as Seema says, be very interesting to see what comes of it. But yeah, also there was a point with the trial, I didn't follow it as closely with Seema, that Republicans are using concept maps, experts who are coming in and saying, hey, this is what you're going to use if you want to get an advantage. And I guess one of the state legislators said, oh, we're not using them. But when it came to trial, said, well, actually, we did use some of these maps to show us how we could get it.
Yeah, that was kind of the bombshell that emerged yesterday, evidently, because the state representative Destin Hall, who now works for a law firm that consults on governmental issues, at the time was leading leading the redistricting of House districts in the legislature. And he told Democrats during that process that he wasn't using anything but the maps that were being shown to the public in real time on the internet. But under oath yesterday testified that, in fact, that was not the case, that he was using maps and that he would go into a back room and look at these maps as the process was unfolding. What are the implications of that, Seema?
Well, I would love to have seen the defense get some type of sanction. And here is why. Evidentiary speaking, the plaintiff said in their closing argument that these concept maps were either lost or destroyed. So what happened to them, right? I mean, if there is evidence that a witness relies on, that evidence should be introduced and the judges should get to see it. If that evidence is in fact lost or destroyed, there should be some type of sanction against the defense, but they never
they asked for sanctions and it was denied, right?
I did not hear that. If that happened, I'm sure they did. I mean, these are, there was like 20 lawyers on the plaintiff's side.
According to reports, the lawyers for the plaintiff asked for sanctions and the judges denied it.
Does it surprise me? You know, I will say it doesn't surprise me because the judges can't unring a bell. The reason, and it's not in front of a jury, right? Because if the judges were to sanction an attorney and it was in front of the jury, then it would have more of an impact. They don't need to sanction them. They know what happened. But I just want to talk about, Mary mentioned the history, and she is so correct that North Carolina has been in front of the Supreme Court since at least the early 90s. There was this case where North Carolina Attorney General takes this one district, that takes their, you know, maps to Janet Reno and says, hey, will you approve these? And she says, no, there's only one black district. So they go back and they come back with two black districts. And then Sandra Day O'Connor says, are you kidding me? That looks bizarre. And the shape of the district, it looks like a lizard. It's just so ridiculous that
North Carolina has been doing this. And the fact that Mary pointed out that a previous court said that some of the previous maps were drawn with surgical precision to eliminate black voter influence in elections. Does that provide precedence for this court to refer to as prima facie evidence of an ongoing pattern of behavior?
Absolutely. Well, sorry, Mary, you go ahead.
No, I'm just also, but it's complicated by the fact that the Voting Rights Act, the preclearance and so much of the meat that had enforcement policies behind it, it was eliminated or very much limited by the Supreme Court in 2013 with the Shelby decision. So that's why they keep coming back and back, hoping they'll get a better outcome. But Seema, you were getting ready to talk about precedent.
Well, actually, so I was referring to, there was one case, Cooper versus Harris, this is 2017. And the reason it's so similar is that in that case, and this went to the Supreme Court, it was based on a 2010 census. So it's very similar. In this case, it's based on the 2020 census. And in that case, they decided that race was the predominant rationale for redistricting. So there is, in fact, not only Supreme Court precedent, but there is local precedent in that the case that was just heard this week was actually addressed previously in the 2016 map. So what happened was there was these 2016 maps that were basically the same maps, and the case was going through the court system, but the judges weren't deciding it fast enough. So the plaintiffs in this trial that you heard from this week, they said, you know what, screw it, we're gonna dismiss the case, we're gonna refile, and let's go to trial. So this has already been decided. That they're not fair, the maps.
So,
but the courts, we have courts that have shown now, with the different makeup of the courts now, that some of them are willing to ignore precedent, including our Supreme Court, but that's a whole other discussion.
The decision is expected on this on Tuesday. Either way, whether they make a decision in favor of redrawing the maps or not, it's liable to be, what's the word I'm looking for?
Frantic? Frantic race to...
Appeal. Liable to be appealed by either side, and the clock is ticking on the primaries.
Yes.
What's liable to happen here, Seema?
Well, the primaries were moved from March to May in an effort to redraw the maps if that is necessary. So if the appeal goes forward, I mean, yes, you're right. Whatever side loses is going to appeal. However, the higher court in that case could say, well, we're still going to go forward with the May primary because the electoral process has to go forward, right? I mean, how much can we delay these elections? Or based on the appeal, they could try to delay the primary, I don't know, two more months. And I mean, courts address emergency appeals all the time.
Okay, well, moving on, because we're going to talk a lot about this on Monday with our guests. Yesterday was the one-year anniversary of the attack on the Capitol and our democracy by insurrectionists who tried to stop the certification of the Electoral College vote. Presidents are rarely critical of their predecessors, but yesterday, President Joe Biden let the hammer fall on Donald Trump for promoting lies and tearing down our democracy.
The former president of the United States of America has created and spread a web of lies about the 2020 election. He's done so because he values power over principle, because he sees his own interest as more important than his country's interest, than America's interest, and because his bruised ego matters more to him than our democracy or our Constitution. He can't accept he lost.
Though he never uttered Trump's name, Biden also accused him of being the puppet master in the January 6th insurrection.
For the first time in our history, a president had not just lost an election, he tried to prevent the peaceful transfer of power as a violent mob breached the Capitol. But they failed. They failed.
So it is becoming apparent that the congressional investigation into that event is leading directly to the Resolute desk in the Oval Office. It's also known that there is no love lost between the current president and the past one. But is it wise for a president to be this vocal about his predecessor in advance of a congressional or Justice Department finding? Or is it something that is necessary to stop the influence of the big lie? Mary.
I think that he felt this tough speech was necessary because as much as you have a pandemic and inflation and all of these other issues, democracy is also a big issue. Some folks felt it came a little bit too late, to tell you the truth. And one of the reasons is that January 6th happened, and you can say it has actually metastasized because the big lie has become the litmus test for Republicans and Republican candidates. We see that even folks who condemned it when it happened, January 6th, Lindsey Graham, Kevin McCarthy, have since come on to become allies. And when Lindsey Graham said that Joe Biden was being political, well, what do you call a mob trying to overturn an election? Some of the people in that group are running for office, and it looks like they may get it around the states, whether it's Secretary of State or election boards that will be able to overturn elections if some of these laws persist in the states that say that they can overturn them.
As you say,
you have polls that are troubling, Mike. Polls that say a good third of American citizens say that in certain circumstances, violence may be justified.
And as you say, people say he took a long time to say something and he should have said something earlier. But yesterday, no question about it, he pulled no punches. He made his point of view perfectly clear.
We're living at an inflection point in history, both at home and abroad. We're engaged anew in a struggle between democracy and autocracy, between the aspirations of the many and the greed of the few. We are in a battle for the soul of America. Are we going to be a nation that accepts political violence as a norm? Are we going to be a nation where we allow partisan election officials to overturn the legally expressed will of the people?
And that brings up the need to find a way to end the filibuster in order for Congress to address the voting rights legislation that is stalled in the Senate. What happens if they don't? Mary?
Well, some say that our democracy is that fragile. We see that we've only had the semblance of a true democracy since the Voting Rights Act of 1965 expanded the franchise. And many are saying that if you don't strengthen that, then we will have elections that everybody will not be able to exercise the vote and the votes could be overturned.
We all see what's happening around the country. We all saw what happened on January 6, 2021. We all see the videotape replays of all that. And yet Republicans are finding a way to rewrite history, and not a single Republican other than Liz Cheney and her father, the former vice president, were in attendance yesterday in day-long observances of what happened just a year ago in the Capitol. Behavior on the part of Republicans was disgraceful and anti-American. And President Biden had this to say.
You can't love your country only when you win. You can't obey the law only when it's convenient. You can't be patriotic when you embrace and enable lies. Those who stormed this Capitol, and those who instigated and incited, and those who called on them to do so, held a dagger at the throat of America.
And those who continue to do so are unfit to serve and hold a public office. With that, we close. Mary C. Curtis, columnist for Roll Call, host of their Equal Time podcast, Seema Iyer, chief legal correspondent for Fox 46, Hunter Zions with WCNC, and Claire Donnelly with WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, pledging to help end child hunger in the Carolinas through ongoing support of Second Harvest Food Bank of Metrolina. Details about this initiative at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.